apes, werewolves, and Katy Perry. Oh my. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today on the show, early humans and the evolution of music. Plus music inspired by humans who become wolves. And later, Katy Perry and other pop contenders for Song of the Summer. But in the background, you're hearing Patrick Doyle's score to the newest installment in the Planet of the Apes franchise. The film Rise of the Planet of the Apes is number one at the box office, proving that people are still fascinated by the relationship between man and ape. This relationship gets a musical spin in the new book from the evolutionary neurobiologist Mark Changizi. It's called Harnessed: How Language and Music Mimicked Nature and Transformed Ape to Man. Mark joins me here in the studio. Thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
Is language and music what separates us from the apes?
They'd be on the very high on the list, and writing would be number three potentially. And of course, the arts generally, and music would be a good argument for being one of the pinnacle pieces of arts that we have. Yeah,
you describe it as a kind of a badge of honor that we wear, but the point of your book, one of the points of your book seems to be that it's not a badge of honor that was sort of innate. We're not hardwired for either language or music.
That's right. And we know, of course, that's the case for writing. And so, you know, this research spilled over from research of mine on how we came to read. And the nice thing about reading is that no one can be confused into thinking that we could potentially have evolved to read, because it's much too recent. And you just go two generations back in most of our families and they didn't read it at all. And yet we read as if we have a reading instinct, in the sense that we learn it incredibly early with relatively little training. We do it constantly all day long. We even have visual areas in our brains which seem to be for it. They're even called visual word form areas. No one thinks that they're really for it, because of course... So the answer as to how we came to read is that writing over human culture shaped itself over time to look like what your visual system was good at processing. It looked like nature. And so that was previous research and fleshing out what could I mean by looks like nature, and trying to make that rigorous and testing it across writing system. So the new thought in this book is this, does this also apply to speech and to music, things that potentially we've been culturally evolving for a long period of time? Could they have shaped themselves to be perfectly shaped for our auditory system, and what our auditory system will like evolutionarily will be certain things out in nature that we already were good at way before we had speech or music.
Well, so if our brains are not innately wired for speech or for music, what are they wired for?
Right. So there's two different stories, because there's two different they're fundamentally different in kind, and you can just feel that even before getting into any of the specifics. One of them is sterile speech sounds. You're not going to pay money to listen to speech sounds in the car on the way and switch to the French station.
Speech doesn't have the emotional weight.
Right. Now, taking away the intonation,
sometimes
it can if it has intonation. But music is inherently evocative. And, you know, on the visual side, we find that as well. The look of writing is not particularly evocative generally, whereas colors are. And I've argued in previous research that, you know, your color vision evolved, and we have color vision is all about faces. Color evolved to sense the emotions on faces, the color modulations on faces. Color is emotional because it's about humans. The most emotional and evocative things in the lives of humans were always other humans, 99% of the time. So if you find some mystery stimulus, mystery artifact that we have, and we're wondering, why is it so evocative? It's probably in some way looking or sounding like humans. So the story for speech and music was, is that speech, my hypothesis, and we've carried out tests, is that speech sounds like just fundamental events around you. And the most common fundamental events around you in a terrestrial world like ours is just solid object events. And you can work out what they sound like, and then you can ask, does human speech have those fundamental grammars of what solid object events sound like? And on the music side, it's something that has to be more evocative. And so it eventually occurred to me that, well, just like we have special mechanisms for recognizing facial expressions on other humans, not dogs, it's a human detector system, we have surely auditory mechanisms to recognize what people are doing when they're moving around us. We can tell the direction they're going, how close they are, their behavior on the basis of their gait, whether they're angry or sad. And we're not aware of these things most of the time. But as you, hopefully after this, if you go back home and you start listening to the sounds of the other people in your house, you'll realize that, whoa, I, I know what they're doing at all times. No one is sneaking up on me. And in fact, you know what your dog is doing all the time. And I'm sure you must be a tenth as good at what dogs are doing in your house than you are about what humans are doing, because we never evolved.
we haven't quite evolved the dog detection system.
Yeah.
So music and speech have evolved in a way that fits the shape, if that's the word, in our brains that's devoted to being aware of our environment, being aware of the other humans that are around us, where they are, what they're doing, that sort of thing.
That's right. So certainly people have talked about cultural evolution before and shaping the structure of language or writing or music to be good for the brain. What I'm putting forth is a very specific hypothesis for culture's main trick, and it's to mimic nature.
Wouldn't other animals have also been hardwired to be aware? Wouldn't dogs have been hardwired to be aware of what other dogs were doing around them? And, you know, certainly they have facial characteristics that they recognize in each other, submission, dominance, aggression, all that kind of stuff. Why didn't they develop speech and music to fit their little doggy brains?
Right. So the thing that the one special thing that humans have, so the short story here that I'm putting forth is that there's nothing qualitatively special about we apes compared to the other apes. We have no language or music instinct. We have no new genetics that underlies super powerful learning mechanisms that somehow where they're all innate and we can break beyond that. No, it's none of that. We're just like them, more of what they're like, quantitatively more, not qualitatively more. What made the qualitative distinction was that once our brains were big enough and our social groups, we were sufficiently social, at some point, cultural evolution, it's sufficiently rich that cultural evolution can get up and running. And once it gets up and running, you have a new blind watchmaker in town that's much faster than natural selection and potentially just as bright. So it can start designing new gene-like things that are out in the environment. Dawkins called them memes, and they're designed to transform old mechanisms, old functions that we did and turn them into new sorts of powers that we never evolved to do. But as far as your brain is concerned, it just thinks that it's doing the stuff that it is good at.
So if we take, you know, a really kind of classic example of human movement in music, the Fats Domino song, I'm Walking. If we pair that up with the sound of a person walking, you're saying that the music has evolved because, again, it fits in our brain. We're sort of hardwired to know what the sound of a foot on gravel means, that beat, that rhythm. And when we hear that in music, it fits.
That's right. So, and there's, you can work out, just like I talked about working out the grammar, quote-unquote, of solid object physical events for speech, you can work out the grammar of what people sound like when they move. And the mapping, in some sense, is people have a gait. They have a footstep, and that's the beat. People have other sounds that are time-locked to those footsteps. Your arms are swinging, and mm-hmm. that's time-locked to it. There's sometimes your feet hit the ground when they go by. Some people are more shuffly, less shuffly. And these time-locked things are the other notes that you find in songs that are time-locked to the beat. You have the pitch. You have pitch contours. Real movers out in the world have pitch contours due to the Doppler shifts. That is the main pitchy things that occur in the world that modulate over time in these ways, and that tells you the direction the person is moving.
So you can tell when someone is coming towards you or moving away because the pitch shifts up or down.
That's right.
According to weather. All right. So someone walking, and then Fats Domino, I'm walking.
Yes, indeed, I'm talking about you and me.
Fats Domino from 1957, and I'm Walkin'. We're speaking with Mark Changizi, the evolutionary neurobiologist and author of the new book, Harnessed, How Language and Music Mimicked Nature and Transformed Ape to Man. The idea, Mark, that music mimicked nature is not an unusual one. We find that in a lot of sort of ancient musical traditions. Australian Aboriginal music, you know, is very depictive of animals and rock formations and rivers and streams. But you're talking about something different. You're talking about specifically, when you say nature, you mean other humans moving in nature.
That's right. That, so it's a very specific hypothesis for what nature, and it's the kind of thing that surely the sounds of other people moving around. It was other people who killed us. It was other people who we need to mate with to have babies. They're the stuff that mattered, not bird songs, not the other kinds of sounds in your environment. They're the really evocative sources of the evocative things in life. And it also turns out to have the structure that you need. I mean, so the case in the book that needs to be made is walking through, deriving in some sense theorems about, okay, humans have these sort of gate kinds of patterns. If it's Doppler shifts, then you can work out, you know, Newton's second law of a second law will tell you certain. You can actually make sort of physics kinds of predictions, and say, well, do you find these physics sorts of predictions in the structure of music? So you can ask questions like this over and over again and see the extent to which music continually has these grammatical structures and explain lots of things people hadn't tried to explain sometimes or could explain before.
Now, in language, you point out that, you know, physical objects around us have basically the grammar consists of hits, slides, and rings. Mm-hmm. You have two physical objects that hit each other or slide past each other, and each of those produces a kind of reverberant sort of ringing effect. Mm-hmm. And this plays out in language through syllables, where you have a kind of a sharp hitting sound, the plosives,
that's right, that there's
followed by a vowel, or the fricatives, you know, the sort of slide, the s and ul and things like that. Also, what's the grammar of music? How does that guy walking in the gravel become Fats Domino song?
So there's a variety of – so let's here's one very simple question about music that you may not have thought to ask. Music inherently, melody, has one pitch at a time. Music is filled with many pitches at a time. We have chords. We've got 77 players in an orchestra playing at once. Yet the data set, for example, that we have of 10,000 classical themes, each of these themes is just a sequence of one note at a time. Mm-hmm. You can always play on the piano the melody one with one finger if you were only blessed with one finger. So why should melodic contours be so simple, yet we're so happy to hear more sounds than that all at once? And the answer comes out trivially from this hypothesis, because the pitch contours in music are telling you about the directions. They're the Doppler shifts of the mover in your midst. Potentially, these are exaggerations, just like a smiley face on the board is an exaggeration of human smile, so it feels different. Cartoons show people moving, zipping faster than they really do. Music is zipping faster, potentially, than real people are moving. And so that's why there's one note at a time, but you can also make other sorts of predictions. You can ask, If an object is passing you quickly, like a car, it'll go.
Right.
It's a big difference between its highest pitch and its lowest pitch. This is sort of the melodic range that it uncovers. If it's going very slowly, it's right. Very little difference.
Right.
So faster movers will have a bigger difference between top and bottom pitch, and slower movers will have a smaller difference. But the other thing that happens when you're a faster mover, you have a faster tempo. You have more steps per minute or second. So it should be the case. There's two measures of speed here. The difference between the top pitch and the bottom pitch tells how fast your song is going. But it's also better be the case that they have a greater tempo. So greater tempo music should be, if this is right, tend to have a bigger difference between the top and bottom of their melodic range, which is actually not what you want if you're a piano player or a player, because that means that every time you have to go faster, you have wider range. You'd like to just stick to the two semitones next to each other on the piano.
Right.
And this is what you find. When you look at faster and faster music, on average, averaging over many sorts of songs, you find that this is a trend. They go wider in the pitch range, not the other way. This gives a flavor of this sort of predictive style.
And a good example, actually, two different parts of the same piece, J.S. Bach's Goldberg Variations. There's this beautiful, sedate opening aria, and the melody, you know, operates within a fairly restricted range. Claudio Colombo playing the aria from the Bach-Goldberg variations. Now, as Mark Changizi was just saying, if his hypothesis is correct, you would expect in faster music that there would be a greater pitch range, that the difference between the highest note in the melody and the lowest note in the melody would be much bigger than in the slow movement. And when we get to variation 17, that doesn't indeed seem to be the case. From the Goldberg Variations by Bach, variation number 17. Mark Changizi's book is called Harnessed: How Language and Music Mimicked Nature and Transformed Ape to Man. So Mark, I understand what you're saying about the sort of the grammar of sound, of, you know, the beat, the rhythm, the pitch, loudness, you know.
And the regularities that tie them together in some particular way rather than other ways.
So those are all things that our brain evolved to. You know, we evolved the ability to hear all of those things, to make those distinctions as a way of identifying potential enemies, mates, identifying family, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
How does that – I mean, it still seems to me that the leap from beat and rhythm and pitch and loudness to actually something intentional as music, that's still a big leap. How does that happen?
So by intentional – of course, the individual composers, I'm not claiming, are
right,
doing this intentionally.
But we as a species, how did that – it still seems like a great chasm to have crossed.
Right. So culture just starts selecting for things. In this case – well, in the case of speech or writing, they just keep trying out different kinds of stimuli, the stimuli that are easiest to process. And in this case, it's not just being easy to process, but it's something along the lines of just – a sheer joy to listen to. And so, you know, I make the joke in the book that now that we understand what music sounds like, one can now beat Beethoven, do something better than what, you know, we can outdo all these guys now. But that's not true at all, because it's we don't know which movements around us are the evocative ones. Which ones really are, that's a different theory that's required to explain that. And this is getting at why certain photographs, for example, some are art and mm-hmm. some are just people's pictures of their families. How do you do this? I don't know that. I don't have answers to that sort of question.
Right. Yeah. The decoder ring, as you the right. secret decoder ring that you talk about towards the end of the book. I have to say, if you read Mark Changizi's book called Harnessed, the Language, How Language and Music Mimic Nature and Transformed Ape to Man, by the end of the book, you will have been hit by a train, had a car dropped on you, had your cat shot out of a tree by your neighbor's kid with his BB gun, and finally, you are abducted by aliens. It's certainly a fun ride for anybody who's interested in this idea of how ape became man through the kind of the medium of music and of language. And Mark, I guess just as a kind of a final question, what are we looking for going forward? I mean, are we done evolving? Do you hope that there's a next step here?
Yeah, so this leads to a much different view to the futurism that you often hear about, that, you know, we're on the cusp of understanding fully the brain or building artificial intelligence that will be able to do things better than the brain. Oh, the sci-fi futures that people imagine always involve doing better than us. And what I'm arguing is that, look, the future is already here. We are better than us in the sense, I mean, whether they were better or not, but we're a fundamentally different creature. We're a new species relative to our Homo sapien, genetically identical ancestors. And it wasn't natural selection that did it. It was cultural selection that designed these artifacts to point our magic, powerful brains in new directions. And just we're going to see more of the same. So it's a much more humanistic version of the future. It's going to be the same old powers that natural selection gave us that are brilliant. And we're not going to really ever understand these. I mean, I have a broader views on this. I really think these things are beyond us for millennia, at least. But we can harness them, and culture is smart enough to harness these things and turn these in new directions, and we'll seem to be doing powers that are like something aliens may have in the future. But there'll be a simple explanation. It'll be some new kind of harnessing that we can't anticipate yet.
The book is Harnessed, How Language and Music Mimicked Nature and Transformed Ape to Man. Mark Changizi, thanks so much for being with us on Soundcheck today.
My pleasure.
And coming up next, we get to know the last werewolf with author Glenn Duncan and singer-songwriter Stephen Coates, who records under the name The Real Tuesday Weld. Stay with us.
Is the hair.